Welcome to the Misadventures in Music podcast. My name is Mick Ord.
My name's Ian Prowse.
And my name is Malik Al-Nasser.
And we'll introduce him very, very shortly.
Sorry, I didn't realise. I thought you were just going round the room. Do you want to start again?
No, we won't. We'll carry on leaving in. I'll make you look a divvy, if that's okay, as our special guest.
Yeah.
And the reason why we've got Malik Al-Nasser in the studio is that he's going to talk about his book and the music of Gil Scott-Heron. And you're a massive fan of Gil, aren't you, Ian?
Yeah, this is when you told me we were doing this podcast, I was very excited because I've always wanted to meet this gentleman here to my left. But reason being is that I'm such a huge Gil Scott-Heron fan. There was never a time that he played Liverpool that I wasn't there. And we even used to go to the International in Manchester. We'd go onto enemy territory to watch him as well. And, you know, so Gil is one of my biggest inspirations.
You saw him six times?
No, would have been more than that. I remember vividly one of the very first times I saw him was at the Mountford Hall here in Liverpool, which is a huge space, and it was high summer, would have been about 84, 85, something like that. And the place was packed because it was so hot, everybody was sat on the floor, right? You know, and it was light because it's high summer, and it sat on the floor. And around about 10 minutes before Gil was due on, from the very back of Mountford Hall came this fella picking his way in amongst, you know, everybody sat on the floor because there's no clear pathway. And it was Gil, just with his bag on his own, walking through the crowd, you know.
Wow, wow.
And everybody's going, Gil, he's going, how's you doing, how you doing? So he had to say hello to 2,000 people on his way to the stage. And I just thought, you know, God, I've never seen any artist do that or be completely not bothered by interacting with the crowd like that. And for me, it just gave me a real feeling of the authenticity of him and his music, yeah. Of which has been, as I say, a massive inspiration on my own music down the years.
Okay, well, fantastic stuff. Well, the first song we're going to play from Secrets is Kane, and then Malik's going to explain why it's important to him.
The rural sound as described by Gene Toomer turn of the century was the inspiration for this song. Two of his characters, of course, it's about the primary product of that area, the cane. Take her in the perfect as dusk when the sun goes down. Take her in the as perfect as twilight as a child, able to drive both the young and old. Take her in the and remember every sound, cause often as our flowers bloom, men will try and cut them down. So take her in the as sweet as spring rain, run from the cane.
For help, That was Kane, Gil Scott-Heron, from the 1978 album Secrets. Malik, welcome. Welcome to the Misadventures in Music podcast. Great to see you.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Mick. Thank you so much for having me, and great to finally meet Ian as well, after many years listening to his stuff.
So why is Kane a big story for you?
Well, my father came from British Guyana, and as anyone knows, Demerara in Guyana is where Demerara sugar comes from. So Demerara was a plantation economy, which was based on the production of sugarcane. And this goes back to slavery. And when I got involved in really trying to trace my ancestry back through Guyana, my father was long since dead, but he used to tell me as a kid, you know, one day I'm going to take you back home to the sugarcane. So I used to sort of have this romantic notion about going to Guyana, this exotic place in South America, and, you know, seeing this sugar cane. But then my father died, and, you know, my life took a different turn after he died. It was a really kind of negative turn when I was taken into care, you know, at the age of 9. And, you know, I never got to get back to the cane. So it always had a kind of a thing in the back of my mind that it's like a place I have to go back to. And eventually I did get to go back to Guyana and study my ancestry and found my family and so on and so forth as a consequence of that endeavor. But what Gil was talking about here in this particular song was the equivalent of what was happening in the southern states of America during the same kind of slavery period, where there was an economy that had built up around certain states in the south, which was predicated on sugar production. And this particular track was taken from a 1923 book by a guy called Gene Toomer, who he mentions at the beginning of the song, you know, the rural south as described by Gene Toomer, and the primary product of the area was cane. So Gene Toomer was one of the authors of the Harlem Renaissance, which was a sort of period in the 1920s, 1930s, where a lot of black authors emerged. Because, you know, during slavery, black people were not allowed to read and write. Like, you could be flogged or even killed for reading and writing. So there was a high level of illiteracy among black people. And as a consequence of that, you know, there was much more of an oral tradition among black people because of that sort of hundreds of years of being forbidden to read and write. So, you know, slavery only officially ended in America in 1867. My father was born in 1918. So he had slavery within living memory of people who were around when he was born. And, you know, Gene Toomer did as well, because when he wrote this book in 1923, he characterized a couple of individuals. So he's talking about, you know, take Corintha, perfect as dust when the sun goes down. He's talking about a character in Gene Toomer's book, Corintha, who men just like flocked to her. But he's also talking about the way black women were sexually exploited during that period by white men. Because when you go to the book, Cain, and you read Gene Toomer's account of it, you can see that, you know, there's a white man who falls in love with this, you know, black woman, but she's just a kid. And, like, over time, he's doing various different sorts of things to try and get with her. And he's reflecting back on a couple of decades earlier during slavery, he would have just been able to take it and no one would have been able to do anything about it. So there's a characterization of that character. And then he talks about another character in the book called Becky. You know, pray for Becky, white woman gave birth to two black sons. Pray for Becky, her one room shack fell to the ground. You know, so this was another character in Gene Toomer's book where the woman was a white woman. She ended up having a black baby and she got ostracized by both the black community and the white community. They took everything away from it and threw it out. So she ended up in a place between the tracks. So there was like the road and the railway, and someone snuck down there who felt sorry for her, got some timbers and built a little shack for her. And she lived in this shack between the train line and the road by herself with her little black child. And then she had another black child. And then at some point, something happened. You know, people used to throw things at her when they saw her. And other people used to go past on the train and throw food, you know, because some people felt sorry for her. But she was completely and utterly cut off because as a white woman, how could she go and have a black child? You know what I mean?
So is this referenced in the song?
This is referenced in the song when he's talking about, you know, pray for Becky, white woman gave birth to two black sons. pray for Becky, her one-room shack fell to the ground. Two boys killed a man and had to leave town. White woman gave birth to two black sons, pray for Becky. The story was that, you know, the kids then grew up and they were ostracized as well, and something happened and somebody got killed and then they all had to leave town. Becky's shack ends up falling down and people said that she was in it when it fell down, and nobody knew because nobody cared enough about her to even go and bury her. So the point of Gene Toomer's book and Gil's references to it in this song is to characterise what was going on in the South in the post-slavery period as recorded by the writers of the Harlem Renaissance, who were the first generation of literate black people coming out of slavery, who were saying, we are here, we are authors, we are going to tell our own stories. Do you know what I mean? And Gil was inspired by the Harlem Renaissance. He references Langston Hughes a lot, you know, as not just a poet, but as an academic, as someone who wrote columns in the, you know, in the mainstream newspapers at the time. These are the people who really inspired Gil. So when you go into Gil's body of work, you know, there's names that you can pluck out and you can go and investigate who these people are. And as you do that, you will get an education into black history. You know, the kind of education that you won't get taught in the colleges and the universities.
That makes it vital work that he's putting historical information into songs for us, you know, primarily a white audience, say, over here. And they're all going, okay, what's this all about? And it's like, it's, you're basically getting remote learning from him, aren't you?
Well, it's a gift that keeps on giving, and this is why I say to people with Gil Scott-Heron, go to this body of work and draw from that well. Do you know what I mean? It's there for us. You know, he's been quite explicit in the narrative to be able to tell us who the characters are that we should be listening to, and you've been to loads of his concerts, Ian, so you'll know that he often talked about, for instance, Fannie Lou Hamer.
Yeah.
So people are like, who the hell is Fannie Lou Hamer? Do you know what I mean? Like, she's not known like Rosa Parks or, you know, Mayor Angelo or any of these kind of, you know, big sort of names of the black protest movement, Sonia Sanchez and people like that, Angela Davis. You know, you say those names, people know who you're talking about. You mentioned Fannie Lou Hamer, people don't even know. But, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer was a woman who, she was a great singer, but she never ever sang commercially. She only ever sang at political rallies, and she was a black woman who was going out in the Klan territory, and she was encouraging black people to vote when the Klan were lynching black people for voting. The Klan were lynching people for turning up to register to vote, and she was out there at rallies, and she was a Christian woman, so she would sing gospel, but she would actually go at the rallies and she would use her singing as a way to galvanize support, if you like, for the cause of getting black people in the post-slavery era to exercise their right to
vote. Outrageous bravery. I mean,
it was for the time, because you're talking, you know, I mean, literally, this is the time the Klan would turn up at your door, they'd be burning crosses on the lawns, yeah. You know, and if they caught you, you know, on your own, they might, you know, just lynch you.
Mm. And there's no, the law wouldn't help you.
The obviously. Law was in the Klan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, Malik, before we go to the next track, it's important that we give a sort of potted history of your life prior to Gil. You met Gil in the 80s, didn't you? You went to a gig at the Royal Court in Liverpool, because you'd had, to say the very least, a difficult teenage years, hadn't you? You'd had a difficult time since you were a kid.
Yeah, I mean, like, the way our life had sort of panned out, you know, my father was born in 1918, came here in the 1930s, you know, so he was like pre-Windrush. And when the Second World War broke out, you know, my father was a merchant seaman. So, as you know, at the time, Guyana was a British colony, so it was British Guyana. So he was served in the supply ships and stuff during the war up until 1942. And then in 1942, he volunteered for the Royal Navy and fought the Nazis for Britain, only to come back to Britain at the end of the war, buy his house and, you know, be in a situation where, like many other black people who come back in the post-war period, you know, where they were just being maligned for even being here, despite the fact that they'd volunteered to fight to defend Britain. Hitler wasn't invading Guyana, you know, my dad didn't need to come here and do that.
Well, it's reflecting what happened to Charles Wootton, wasn't it?
Exactly what happened with Charles Wootton at the end of the 1919 race riots. Again, he came back from World War One. He was one of the Black Tommies, you know, Walter Tull and those other guys. And they'd fought for Britain in the war, and then they'd come back after the war. And, you know, there was letters that I've seen of the Lord Mayor of Liverpool writing to the Secretary of State in 1918 and asking for money to repatriate the Ethiopians, as they called them, because all black people were Ethiopians. It didn't matter where you came from. Come from Jamaica, you're still Ethiopian. But, you know, because the white soldiers had come back from the war and the black labour force that had been brought in from Africa and the Caribbean had been working the factories, the munitions factories and stuff. And then when the white soldiers came back and they didn't have jobs, they were like, why these black people got jobs and we haven't got jobs? Send the Ethiopians back and give us the jobs. So they'd asked for one year's salary and a one-way ticket back to Africa or the Caribbean, and the Secretary of State refused to give it to them. So consequently, they refused to leave the jobs. And then, the tensions grew up, and a group of, you know, sort of white mob, if you like, lynch mob, you could say, chased, you know, a young man from, I think he was from Bermuda or the Bahamas, I can't remember which one, Charles Wharton, chased him down Parliament Street, beat him to death and threw him in the Mersey. And that launched the 1919 race riots. So when you come to post-war Britain, you know, you're talking about Enoch Powell. Now, at the time, Enoch Powell's like out in the Caribbean campaigning for black people to come to Britain to do the reconstruction because there was not enough white people to do it. And that's, you know, in the mid-1940s, you know, after the war, 1950s. And then by the time you get to the early 60s, Enoch Powell's doing his kind of, you know, rivers of blood and all this kind of stuff and wanting to throw them all out. So they brought black people in to do the jobs that they couldn't do when there was a labour shortage because of war. And then afterwards, they just threw them back out again. So in my father's case, you know, he'd come and he'd bought his house on Warwick Street. If anyone remembers Warwick Street in those days, you've got the sort of two-storey terraces on one side, but then you had the three-storey Georgian townhouses on the other side with a basement level. So we had one of those, 53 Upper Warwick Street, and he bought that outright, as all the black seamen did, because white people wouldn't rent houses to black people at that time. You know, there was the famous sign, no dogs, no blacks, no Irish. So if you couldn't, you know, rent a house, you had to buy a house, and the seamen had all come back with cash. So they would buy their houses and they would own their houses. But then what the council would do is when there got to be too many concentration of black people together, they'd use their powers of compulsory purchase order to disperse the community. It's a principle they call dilute and disperse, which is the same as what you use with pollution. You know, because you think you've got one part pollution to 10 parts water, you can still drink the water. So they thought if you can bring the black people over here and concentrate them in ghettos for a period of time, teach them how to be British, and then disperse them out, and then through marital assimilation and whatever, they will breed the black out of them, and eventually they'll lose their culture and they'll lose their colour and they'll just become indistinguishable from the whole society. So they say it's assimilation, but what it actually is acculturation. They annihilate your culture. And that's done through housing policies, through social policy. So there is, you know, if you go to the black community from that period and you talk to them, nearly everyone would say, we owned our own house, we got a compulsory purchase order. Right. And then they got shipped out to Runcorn or Kirby or Skelmersdale or Halewood or
Garston
or whatever, you know, Netherley in our case, you know, Highton or whatever. And then there'd be one black family or two or three black families among, you know, tens of thousands of white families. And that would be the beginnings of the end for them. So in my case, like, once we got shipped out, you know, our house was taken in 1969 and we were put out to Netherley, there was only four black families, 100,000 white families, and it was, you know, we were getting called every name under the sun. We were being treated like we didn't belong. We were being attacked on a daily basis. And then my father got sick and had a stroke and became a quadriplegic and went in hospital. And within 12 months of him going in hospital, I'd been taken into care. And in the care system in 1970s, I got taken in 75. It was absolutely brutal. And I was moved from one care home to another and being beaten and, you know, out of school and, you know, no qualifications and not getting taught and being forced to work on a farm and all this kind of stuff. So when I should have been in school. So the kind of experience that I had was brutal. So at 18, they just like say, okay, you're out of care now. And then they put me in a hostel for homeless black youths, dumped me on the street with £100, made me sign a form to say I'd never come back for any more. And at that time, I'm semi-literate. I couldn't read and write properly. So, you know, that was an 18-year-old me. And our kid worried that I was just going down the wrong path and I was getting into stuff and I was meeting the wrong people and I had no positive role models. And, you know, I had no prospects. I couldn't go and get a job. I couldn't say where I'd gone to school because I never went to a proper school. I couldn't say, you know, I'd not on a CV. I'd never done a proper job, you know. So I was completely outside of the system. I was in the underbelly of society, do you know what I mean? And living in a hostel for homeless black youths, I didn't even have a home. I was dismembered from my family. So at this point, I was like on a pathway to prison. Do you know what I mean? It was the streets were beckoning. That's all that was available to me was the streets. So our kid just thought, you know, you're going in the wrong direction, man. You need some inspiration. So he decided to sit me down one day in his flat. He used to have a flat on Devonshire Road, the Cavendish Gardens, just by Sunnyside. And he sat me down and he just said, listen to this. And he put this album on. And it was Moving Target by Gil Scott-Heron. And there was a track on there called Washington, D.C. And he played the track and then he made me listen to it. And then he went like that to me afterwards. He said, what did that mean to you? And I'm like, I have no idea. Then he explained it and he broke it down, you know, symbols of democracy pinned up against the coast, the outhouse of bureaucracy surrounded by a moat, citizens of poverty are barely out of sight, the overlords escape in the evening, brothers on the night, you know, and he starts talking about the ghettos of Washington, D.C. and how you see the image of the White House, you see the Lincoln Memorial and Capitol Hill and all of this, but the reality of it is northeast, you know, southeast D.C., you know, the capital of America, the surrounding neighborhoods of the White House were all black. They called it the Chocolate City, and the people there were completely excluded from the political process, but they were totally and utterly ghettoized, you know, and had been since slavery and colonialism. And it was slaves that actually built the Capitol building, and it's slaves that designed and built the White House, but they never got involved in the process. They were just used for the labor and for the, you know, to build the infrastructure, but never got any of the beneficial interest out of what came out of that, and had absolutely no power within it. And it was really that song that and the description that our kid gave to me at the end of it that woke me up to, you know, what was really going on in the world, that it wasn't just about Toxteth and Liverpool and what was happening there. The same ghettoization and that same oppression was happening globally.
Symbols of democracy pinned up against the coast, outhouse of bureaucracy surrounded by a moat, citizens of poverty are barely out of sight, the overlords escape near evening, the people on the night. Morning brings the tourists, staining eyes and rubber necks, perhaps a glimpse of the cowboy making the world a nervous wreck. It's a massive irony for all the world to see, it's the nation's capital, it's Washington, D.C. It's the nation's capital, it's the nation's capital. Have the glitter on the glamour of LA, may not have the history or the intrigue of Bombay, but when it comes to making music and showing up making news, people who just don't make sense and people making do, seems a ball of contradictions pulling different ways between the folks who come and go and the ones who got to stay. Of irony for all the world to see, it's the nation's capital, it's Washington, D.C. It's the nation's capital, it's the nation's capital, it's the nation's capital, it's Washington, D.C. Seems to me, spend a lifetime, leave a night up on 14th Street, make me feel it's always the right time. Cause them people showed up in loving me. It didn't make but one second enough. It's the nation's capital. It's the nation's capital. It's the nation's capital. It's Washington, D.C. Of democracy pinned up against the coast, the outhouse of bureaucracy surrounded by a moat, citizens of poverty are barely out of sight, the overlords escape near evening, the people on the night. bring the tourists painting rubbernecks. Perhaps a glimpse of the cowboy making the world a new trick. It's a massive irony for all the world to see. It's the nation's capital, it's Washington, D.C. See, it's the nation's capital. It's the nation's capital. It's the nation's capital. Washington, D.C. Capital, got you feeling capital. The punishment is capital in Washington, D.C. You know, it's the nation's capital. It's the nation's capital. The punishment is capital in Washington, D.C. It's the capital.
As ever, the musicianship in his music, you know, beautiful, doesn't get mentioned enough. So can you tell us how you came then to have this relationship with Gil? And what I want to know, what I've always wanted to ask you, if I ever got to meet you, is what was he like?
Yeah, I mean, Gil was the most approachable of people. People think of him as an artist, but it's really the wrong way to look at Gil. Yeah, he was an artist, he was an author, he was a poet, and so on and so forth. But first and foremost, Gil was an activist.
Activist, yeah.
When I toured with him, I got to meet some of these musicians, obviously, and one of them was a guy called Bilal Sunni Ali. He's the guy who actually wrote the melody for what became Gil's biggest hit, The Bottle. So he's a saxophonist and horn player, you know. And Bilal told me that at the time when they first started off with Gil Scott Heron and the Midnight Band, it was an opportunity to go into the southern states, into the rural areas, and encourage black people to vote. Now, this is the time when, you know, the NAACP, you know, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, were sending, you know, Martin Luther King and you know, white liberals and stuff. They were going into the South and trying to encourage people to vote, you know, during the presidency of Johnson and stuff. The act had been passed to give black people the vote in, I think it was 65. And black people were not taking that up because the KKK and, you know, white supremacists in the southern states were threatening black people of what would be the case if they did vote. So, you know, there was all this moves with all these white liberals and stuff who were coming down and being arrested by the police and beaten up by them. And in some cases, they even killed and lynched, like, white liberals for coming down and doing that. So if you were trying to do voter registration in the South at that time, you were taking a risk with your life. So Gil wanted to do the voter registration because he'd grown up in the South, you know. His mum was in Chicago working, and his father, Gil Heron Sr., had gone
footballer.
To... Footballer. He was a footballer, and he'd gone to Scotland to play for Celtic. He was Celtic's
Black player.
They called him the Black Arrow, yeah. So, you know, Gil didn't really grow up with his father. He didn't know his father. He didn't meet him until he was, like, 26. So he'd gone off, and the mother, you know, took her son Gil down south to, you know, to his grandmother Lily Scott, who raised him in Jackson, Tennessee. So he's in Tennessee in the deep South, you know, near to Memphis and all of those places, and that's where he was exposed to the music of the blues, but that's where he was also exposed to the Ku Klux Klan and that whole Jim Crow laws of racial segregation, which was the American equivalent of apartheid South Africa. And he was very much affected by those experiences, and that permeated throughout his music. Later on, he wrote songs like The Klan. He Who Rides With The Klan Is A Devil And Not A Man, you know, and he wrote a lot of other songs as well, which touched on the subjects of racial segregation, you know, South Africa, South Carolina. He compared what was happening in apartheid South Africa with what was happening in South Carolina with the Jim Crow laws and racial segregation. There's other ones where he talks, you know, in my lifetime, I've been in towns where there was no freedom or future around. I've been in places where you could not eat or take a drink of water wherever you please. So these, when there was, you know, coloured fountains and white fountains, you know, coloured toilets, white toilets, coloured diners, white diners, you know, and this was part of the whole segregation thing. So at least, even though there was constitutional equality, if you like, with the 14th Amendment of the American Constitution, there had been state laws which had said separate but equal. So therefore, you know, everything could be separated and it was considered equal. But of course, you know, the facilities for whites were not equal to the facilities for blacks. And it wasn't until the 60s where that was struck down with legislation like Brown versus Board of Education, you know, Dred Scott case and all of these kind of stuff. So when those cases happened and that changed the laws, it became possible for black people to have parity in terms of voter rights and so on in the late 60s. And then Gill was trying to encourage that. But he knew that if he went down into those places, what was happening to Martin Luther King with the Selma thing and what was happening to, you know, white liberals and stuff who were going down there doing that, would happen to him. So he formed a band. So that was the Midnight Band. So the guy who was the road manager, a guy called Tommy Abney, he was, him and Bilal Sunni Ali were the midnight movement of the Midnight Band. So they were concerned with the activism element of it. So when they would arrive in a place, you know, the police would like, you know, what are you doing down here, boy? You know, yeah. And they'd be like, oh, there's a poster over there. We're playing tonight at the band. And they say, okay, then carry on. And they wouldn't say anything to them. Then they'd go to the barber shop and start talking to people. You know, you need to vote. And then they'd get invited to people's houses to go to the cookhouse.
So the band was a cover.
Yes, the band was a complete cover for the activism.
Amazing.
What a great
concept.
So, but you were asking before we started the interview about like how accessible Gill was. This is how he became so accessible, because he started off campaigning for voter registration and campaigning for civil rights and human rights. So that necessitated him going directly to the people. Yeah. Yeah. And what that did was it endeared him to the people. Yeah. So when the time he say, you know, at the end of the day, okay, we've done our job, we've encouraged people to vote, we're in Alabama or Mississippi, wherever. Oh, by the way, we've got a concert tonight. People will just come to the concert. Yeah. So the concert and the music was incidental.
PR, isn't it?
but it wasn't designed in that way. It was the complete antithesis of that. When you're doing PR, you're going out there and trying to interest someone in what you're doing so that they'll come and spend money and come and see you perform.
It's the other way around, isn't it?
It was the other way around. He was very there for them.
Very sophisticated, though, isn't it? You know, in retrospect, it's really sophisticated, that.
I mean, it was undercover campaigning from someone who fully understood what he was up against.
Yeah.
You're up against people who will kill you if they know what you're doing. So you have to find a way to do it, or you just don't do it.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in the South were not voting because they were too scared of what would happen to them if they did vote. So the people from the North were coming down and saying, you need to exercise that, because, you know, if you don't exercise those rights you've been given, you might as well not have those rights. And people have died so that you can have these rights. You have to take the risk and go out and vote. And everything was being done to discourage them for voting, because people thought they're going to vote Democrats, and then, you know, they're going to get elect liberals, and then, you know, there's going to be liberals in the Supreme Court, and they're going to overthrow Jim Crow. And, you know, there was all these kind of things that were going on. So there was voter suppression on a massive scale. And we're seeing a return of that now with what Trump's doing. I mean, since Trump came into power, there's been, I don't even know, I think dozens of legislations at state level that have been passed which would disqualify primarily black people from voting. And as a consequence of this, you know, they are trying to ensure that they can get a conservative, right-wing, far-right agenda through various different state legislatures, and then use that to kind of dial back, if you like, the progress that has been made from the civil rights movement.
As you said there about Gill understood what he was up against.
Because he lived in Jackson, Tennessee, grew up with it.
And he was primarily an activist. I absolutely adore that, because that really says it for what it is. It's not about fame or getting
all of that
men
was incidental.
Or women. It's rubbish, you know. It was about activism. And he also knew that things had to be done pragmatically. And he would sing, freedom ain't nothing but a word. So we can all sing and dance about this. But on the ground, we need to change things for real. You know what I mean? So, and he gave up all of his time and all of his efforts to that, didn't he? So,
and in a way, his relationship with you was kind of part of that, wasn't it? Because you met him in, what, 84?
Yeah, so, you know, what he did for me was a physical manifestation of that rationale, which was taking the revolution, if you like, out of the South, out of the Americas, and spreading it around the world. I mean, conceptually, it's not far removed from what Che Guevara was doing when he exported, you know, the kind of Cuban revolution and he went out to Colombia and the Caribbean and different stuff. You know, they have the idea that the only way that the revolution would really take hold and have effect is if it spread.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So if you take that same concept, although they were doing it in the form of a physical violent conflict, you know, in the case of, you know, what Gil was doing, it was more of an artistic revolution, because Gil used to say to me, the beginning of the revolution is when you change your mind. Not all revolution has to be violent conflict. It doesn't all have to be direct action, although there's a time and a place when that will come. So Gil was engaged in going out there and promoting, if you like, these revolutionary ideas to change people's mindsets globally. But he believed that in order to do that, you had to enact that on the ground in the places that you went to. And every place he went to on tour was another opportunity to access the people of that place and to change minds and to change lives within those
Hence
places.
Hence why I saw him picking his way through the Mountford Hall and saying hello to everybody.
Yeah, he didn't go in through the back door and, like, you know, wait to come out and be announced on stage to rapturous applause. You know, he walked in through the front door and walked through the crowd and stopped talking to people along the way. And that was that degree of accessibility that he had. So on the night that I met him in 1984 at the Royal Court Theatre in Liverpool, you know, I've turned up, I'm 18 years old, I'm semi-literate, I'm homeless, I've got no money, do you know what I mean? I've got no ticket, it's sold out. And I just arrived there and I thought, I've got to get in. And it was just, as I saw people sort of corralled all round the side, queuing up to get in and whatever, by the stage door, I saw a friend of mine called Penny Potter. And anyone who knows Penny Potter knows that she was a photographer in the 80s. She used to live with Paul Agoro, who was the guy who had the pub on the, you know, at the Pilgrim, is it? He used to have the Pilgrim. So Paul was, at the time, used to live with Penny. And Penny used to go around the community taking photographs in black and white in the 80s. And Penny since passed away. But on that night, she was there as a photographer. So she had a backstage pass. And I was like, Penny, get us in, do you know what I mean? So she told the guy on the door that I was her assistant. So I get in backstage now, blags me way in. Now I'm in the press pit now at the front, so I've got like prime vantage points to see the show, do you know what I mean? Place is packed. But what had happened was a lot of the black community had turned out to see Gil, but they'd met him before the show, which was very kind of consummate with like his way of doing stuff. Because during the riots, there was a group of black organizations that had emerged called the Liverpool 8 Black Caucus. So it was an amalgam of a number of activists and organizations that had collectively tried to form a kind of a lobby, if you like, to try and get, you know, the issues of the black community that emerged from the 1981 Toxteth riots.
It was an uprising as well, wasn't it? It wasn't just a
It was Thatcher's Britain, you know, it sparked what was called the Long Hot Summer of 1981, which, you know, once the Toxteth riots went up, Chapel Town in Leeds went up, Moss Side in Manchester, Tottenham, Brixton, you know, St. Paul's in Bristol, they all went up. So it become, you know, a clarion call, if you like, for, you know, for black people to rise up across the country. And, you know, as a consequence of that, you know, there was a public inquiry. Lord Gifford did the public inquiry and the book Loosen the Shackles was produced and so on. But the Liverpool 8 Black Caucus had turned up at the show prior to the show and had met with Gil to articulate the issues that the black community in Liverpool were facing with racial segregation, with, you know, being kept out of the job things. We couldn't get into clubs at that time. There's only two clubs that would let us in, Quinn's and Kirkland's. The people were being turned away from chauffeurs and being turned away from all the big clubs at the time. They wouldn't let black people in. They had a policy on the door. You know, there was no black people working in the shops in town. It was just, Liverpool was whitewashed. Like, if you were black, you were on the periphery and you were lucky if you got anything in Liverpool at that time. And, you know, the one thing that you could be guaranteed that you would get was hassled by the police. And it was that whole police brutality thing that was going on at that period that really sparked the Toxteth riots. So the Liverpool 8 Black Caucus came and they met with Gil and they had a t-shirt and they actually asked Gil to wear their t-shirt on the show. So there's pictures of him by Penny Potter with the Black Caucus t-shirt that night in 1984 on the stage. And I had obviously gone in with Penny. I had the backstage pass, so I had the ability to be able to get backstage. I've watched this show. I mean, mesmerizing. You talked, Ian, about the musicianship. I mean, you've got the bass player, Robbie Gordon, incredible bass player, you know, influenced by Victor Wooten, Stanley Clarke, you know, those kind of people. You've got the saxophonist, Ron Holloway. I mean, Ron was with Gil for years, and then he left Gil to go with Dizzy Gillespie, and he stayed with Dizzy Gillespie until Dizzy died. That's the level of, you know, kind of skill set that you're talking about. There was a guitarist from Manchester, actually, a guy called Lynn Oakey, who's gone off the scene, and I don't know what happened to Lynn. Lovely guy. The drummer at the time was Steve Walker, who had previously been Dionne Warwick's drummer, and the percussionist at the time, Larry MacDonald. So Larry MacDonald.
Was anyone playing flute at that show? I can't remember.
Not at that particular show, no. The flautist would have been Brian Jackson prior to that, but Brian Jackson had left the year before. Okay. So this was the first sort of band that had emerged post-Brian Jackson. So Brian Jackson had played the flute on the bottle and other stuff for the when they'd done the album with Strattard East. But then obviously when they'd signed with Arista, there was several albums with Arista, the first few albums which featured Brian Jackson, but then Brian Jackson left. So Gil Scott-Heron and Brian Jackson and the Midnight Band had finished by this point, and Gil had started a new band called A Mere Facade, which then morphed into later on what became the Amnesia Express. Yeah. So it's the same kind of characters in A Mere Facade as what you would find later on in the Amnesia Express. But the level of musicianship was totally off the charts. And
how did you feel at the end of the gig? You'd watch this, I assume, life-altering, you know, moment. What were you thinking then?
Well, I was mesmerized by it. I mean, it was the most captivating performance that you could ever imagine. I don't think I've ever seen a gig like it since. It was a moment in time. Gil had captured a moment in time. He was one with the audience.
He was the best communicator I think I've ever seen, including Joe Strummer, live on stage, in terms of the way he communicated with the audience. All of those ideas, all of that information, that it would just flow through you, and it was a beautiful experience watching him.
Well, Gil had a number of different facets to him beyond the music, and that, I mean, obviously he could just sit down at the piano. He played the Fender Rhodes, you know, to get that old kind of organic kind of sound that he liked, you know, and he'd sit there and he'd be doing his little diminished chords and stuff. He could captivate a room just by himself. He had this aura, and then he would bring the audience in with him. He would do stand-up routines as well. So he'd do some narrative, and it would almost be like as if you were listening to like a stand-up comedian like Richard Pryor or Chris Rock or something, because he would have you in stitches. But he would satirize serious issues. So if he was talking about apartheid South Africa, or he was talking about, you know, Gary Tyler, you know, being incarcerated in the Angola State Penitentiary for having committed no crime, which UB40 later did the song Tyler is Guilty, the white judge, he said so and so on, you know, or he would talk about, you know, Stevie Wonder trying to, you know, get Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday as a national holiday, or he would talk about
Black Panthers. He did a lot on, didn't he?
Yeah, and also the Reaganomics was going on at the time, because it was Margaret Thatcher and Reagan and the special relationship that was going on. So we had Thatcher's Britain and they had Reagan's America, you know, Star Wars and all that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of different issues, core issues that were going on. African liberation movements to, you know, Cuban missile crisis, Bay of Pigs invasion, I mean, CIA, you know, flooding the black communities with cocaine, you know, after the civil rights movements and stuff. So he would tackle all these issues, but he would satirize them in a way. It was almost like a spoon of sugar with the medicine, do you know what I mean? Like, because of the way he satirized the situation, he would have you laughing and thinking at the same time.
Yeah. It wasn't preachy.
No, not at all. He was not the guy stand up there and, like, you know, lecture you. Yeah. He would sort of draw you into a conversation in a way where he would use irony in such a way that you would feel as though you were part of the conversation, even though it was only him that was talking. And that is what created that connection with the audience.
It was deeply poetic. Mm-hmm. And the timbre of his voice as well. Yeah. It all went together. To, as you said, to these other skills that he had.
But it created like that atmosphere.
Was he like that with you when you met him after the gig?
So the gig finished. I need to know everything. I don't want any of it missing out. I've been waiting for this moment.
Well, it's all.
So the gig finishes.
It's all in the book. Yeah. It's all in the book. I direct people to read the book. Letters to Guild by Malik Al-Nasser. The book is literally out. And I go into this in deep detail, but I'll give you a sort of a sense of it. So, you know, after the gig, Penny goes backstage and she's trying to get her photographs, and the promoter's there and the band's there and everyone's rushing around, you know, Gil, and you know, people are trying to get paid, and you know, reporters are trying to get interviews and all this sort of stuff, and I'm standing there really just like a fish out of water, completely mesmerized by his persona and his presence, but at the same time not wanting to intervene and be like too cheeky, or you know.
Well, you were only 18.
Well, it's not just that. I was like, I wasn't like, how can I put it, I'm an assertive guy, and even at that point I was an assertive guy, but I was in the presence of greatness, and it's a humbling experience when you come into the presence of someone like that, because you don't want to put a foot wrong, you don't want to offend them in any way, you don't want to make them feel bad about something that you've done. So I didn't want to just walk up to him and just be like in his face, you know, when everyone else was in his face. And I was looking from the back end of the room, and I just, it was like piranhas feeding on a piece of flesh, you know. Everyone wanted something from him. There was like, oh Gil, what do you think about this? And then the, you know, people from Black Hawks were like, oh Gil, what do you think about that? And we should be doing this, and you know, what are we going to do about that? And the reporter, can I get an interview? And the band, yeah, we need to get paid. And the promoter's trying to do stuff, and the media is all stuffing mics under his nose. And I just thought to myself, I remember standing across the room just watching it. It was almost like surreal kind of outer body experience. Like I'm just watching this guy, and I'm thinking to myself, everyone's trying to take something from him. Didn't he give enough on the stage? And now it's like he's come off the stage, he's given his all, and people are still feeding on him. Yeah. And it didn't sit right with me. Do you know what I mean? So I thought, I can't just take anything from him. I don't know. I want to give him something, but I don't know what to give him. So I just thought to myself, I can just give him a compliment. But at that point, the promoter decided there's too many people in the room. So we started clearing everyone out. So he starts, you know, making this gestures with his hands, and I'm thinking, I'm not going to get a chance to see him. So I sort of backed up a little bit, and then I saw this guy who I knew, who was like, he was from the area, actually. He was a skinhead. His name was John Robbo. But when I'm talking skinhead, I'm talking bib and braces, you know, hobnail boots, half-mast jeans, you know, shaved head, like full-on skinhead, do you know what I mean? Wow. But he loved black people. It's just like,
well, that's the original skinhead movement didn't it? Yeah. It was deeply affected by West Indian music.
He was very much, you know, he was very much involved with people in the community and stuff, and he was a good lad, but he was like the only skinhead I knew that like you didn't have to run if you saw him, you know, or fight. And I was like, listen Rob, I need to, you know, you work in security. And he was like, yeah. So I just need to see this guy. So there used to be this like spiral staircase, and he said, yeah, I'll go and sit up the top of that there, and then when they've cleared out, I'll call you down and I'll get you in. So I did, and I sat up there. It felt like an eternity, but it was only like probably just a few minutes. They cleared everyone out, and then he saw his little baldy head, and he just motioned me to come down, and I came down, and everyone was cleared out apart from a few people, and then he just swung the door open, and there was Gil. And as I walked in, I was kind of like, you know, just thought, I just want to go and give him a compliment. And he just cast a smile at me, and he just put me at ease, you know what I mean, immediately, as if like, it's all right.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know what it was with him. He had an ability to look at people and just read them. And I was in probably the most traumatized state that I'd ever been in. I'm 18 years old. I've had 9 years in care. I've been living on a council estate prior to that, being beaten up and called every name under the sun on a daily basis prior to that. I've been worked on a farm like a slave throughout my childhood when I should have been in school. I can't read and write. I'm homeless. I'm skint. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'd been through it. My dad had died. You know what I mean? I'd been, you know, disjointed from my family and my mum and stuff. You know what I mean? I was literally on my own. And I don't know what he saw in me. And later on, he says that, you know, he says, I don't know what I saw in the brother. I just, sometimes you just see something and you feel you should do something. And he did. But I just, you know, I just went over to him and I shook his hand and said, Gil, man, you really moved me. You know, it was a wonderful concert and I really appreciate it. And thank you very much. And then I turned around to leave, and then he called me back. And I was like, you know, okay. And he's like, you know, I heard you all had some riots around here and stuff. And I was like, yeah. So started talking about the riots. And then he said, you know, I want to see for myself. Can you take me and show me? And I was like, okay. Wow. So he said, well, we'll get these guys back to the hotel. And then, you know, you can take me. And he called the promoter. And he went, look, I want to go and see this area. He's going to take me around, you know. Let's get them back to the hotel. He said, get on the bus and come with us. You know, he said, pick up some drums or something. So I'll pick up a couple of drums and took them out and load them on the bus. And next thing, I'm on the tour bus with them and we're driving back to the Atlantic Towers. And then when we get to the Atlantic Towers, there's like a couple of people, like reporters waiting there and stuff for interviews. So he does a couple of little interviews and stuff, and then the band are there, and then everyone sort of wanders off. And then he called the promoter over again and he said, come on, we'll get on the bus. And then we got on the bus and I ended up taking him round to a tour of like Parliament Street and Lodge Lane, all the riot areas and stuff that night. And as we got talking, you know, he said to me, we've got a day off tomorrow. He said, we're going to be here. He said, why don't you come down? And I said, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you come to me and I'll cook a meal for you guys? Because I could cook, you know. I couldn't read, but I could cook.
Yeah.
You know, so so he said...
Hang on, while you're on the tour bus, you've watched the gig.
Yeah, it's just me and Gil now, and the promoter.
You've managed to get to say, to give him the compliment.
Yeah.
But now you're outside of all that situation and you're on the tour bus and you're showing him around your home.
Yeah, the mad thing was that I probably considered myself at that time to be the least important person in the room.
Yeah.
Because I had no sense of self-worth as a human being.
Yeah.
I had been completely dehumanized, you know, as a
and
black
there
man.
You are, sat with one of the greatest artists in the world. How were you, was your bottle going or were you okay?
No, it was just, you know what, I can't, like, retrospectively I can sit back and I've analysed it loads, do you know what I mean? But the reality is of how I was feeling at that moment in time, I felt safe for the first time in a long time. And to be honest with you, once Gil kind of, the word went out that I'd sort of, you know, hung out with Gil, people saw me in a different light.
This is, would it be going too far?
Like gangsters and stuff backed off.
Right. Would this be going too far to say, this saved your life?
It did. And that's the article I did in The Guardian. It was called Gil Scott Heron Saved My Life, because it did. I mean, I was on a path to destruction. I mean, look, 30% or more of the prison population of this country have been in care. 67% of the female population of this country were in care. The female prison population. Okay? The care system is a method of institutionalization which is preparing you for the prison system. When you take away someone's dignity, you take away their self-worth, you refuse them education, you know, you put them in a situation where even if they come from familial breakdown like I did, you're putting them in with criminals. You know, you're getting a criminal education, you've been surrounded by criminals, and then you make them homeless at 18 and throw them on the streets. With all the safety net that they would have with their family is gone. They couldn't say what school they went to because they never went to a proper school. They got no education. They got no qualifications. They got no, you know, work experience. They've got nothing. What are you doing? You're putting them on the street. And the only people who are going to come to them and say, yeah, I've got a little something for you to get on with here is a gangster.
Yeah.
So these are the only role models that you'll have, which is why it's unsurprising that those population, prison population statistics reflect so highly with people who've been in the care system.
Right.
What Gil was doing in that sense was reaching into that, if you like, even though he had no duty to do so. He was not, you know, acting in loco parentis or in lieu of the parents as the state was when they take you into care and make you a ward of the state. He didn't have a duty of care to me. He wasn't responsible for me. He's no familial connection. He's not even British. Do you know what I mean? So, but his nature, you know, he had values that were inculcated in him by his grandma. And his grandma, Lily Scott, used to say to him, if you could help someone, why wouldn't you? Yeah. If you could help someone, why wouldn't you? That was a simple principle that was instilled in him as a child when he himself was being helped by his grandmother when his father was not there to look out for him. So when he saw me in the situation I was in, he was in a position where he was riding high on the charts, he had a record out, you know, he was touring, he was signed to Arista, he was, you know, he was touring the world. He had money, he had, you know, he had everything at his disposal. It was nothing for him to reach in and help this homeless guy in Liverpool.
Just by when you go to walk away out the dressing room and he calls you back.
That was the life-changing moment.
That's mad, isn't it?
I always say to people, that is the moment that my train changed track, because what he did at that moment was he gave me hope. He gave me an opportunity to be able to move in a different direction, to take my life in a completely different direction than what he'd taken it in before.
That's amazing. That really is amazing. I'm moved by this story, and it's beautiful to hear it firsthand, because Gil's always meant so much to me personally. when my daughter was born 10 years ago, me and her mother lasted 5 minutes, which is, you know, always a traumatic thing because there's a baby, blah, 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 and Gil's song, you know, Your Daddy Loves You, got me through that
from
stuff.
The album Realize.
Yeah, and he's directly singing about the same thing to a young, you know, daughter. I'll always love you, just because there's this stuff going on between me and your mother. This is, and so on a much smaller scale than you, than yourself, Gil absolutely helped me through some very difficult, you know, sticky.
And I've heard a lot of stories like that where he's touched people's lives in so many different ways, just with his body of work. But I've also heard a lot of stories from people who he met along the way that he did that for too. He was that kind of guy. You know, I've met a lot of celebrities along the way, and the amount of them that are completely and utterly inaccessible is disproportionately high. And even of the ones that you might get to meet, and they might give you 5 minutes, you know, to hear what you've got to say, beyond that, they're just trying to get on the tour bus and get out the way, or get onto the next gig, or do, you know, whatever, because they're there for a business purpose. Yeah. They're there to deliver the thing that's going to give them the money.
What's Gil doing? He's going, take me around the ghetto, I'm going to hang out.
Do you know what I mean?
I'm going around to your house.
But when you think of that's how he started, going to the barbecues, going to the barber shops, encouraging people to vote, meeting with the community. It wasn't just me. He met the Black Caucus. He met every black organisation that was represented post-riot era in Toxteth before the gig.
What an energy.
And wore their T-shirt on the night of the gig. He connected with the people of the places that he went to, and he did that so that he could learn. Gil was a perpetual student. He was teaching from the stage, but he was learning backstage. He was garnering information constantly from the different places, and that would provide the context for his body of work. And there's an example of that in 1988 when Gil invited me to come on tour in the States. So he was doing a tour with a guy called Richie Havens, someone who, at the time, I didn't know who he was. I mean, it was years and years and years later when I'm in the HMV store and I'm thumbing through the DVDs and I see a DVD for Woodstock 69.
He's the first time, wasn't he?
And then I put it on. I'm like, oh my God, there's Richie opened Woodstock 69. Do you know what I mean? It's like the biggest, most iconic gig of the history of gigs.
Yeah.
And Richie's there opening it. And I did a whole tour with the guy and I had no clue who he was. And he was funny, Richie. He used to say, hey, brother man, just let it be what it is. That was his answer to everything. He was just a man of few words. So, you know, there was a Black History Month tour and Richie and Gil had the same agent. So if Richie had a gig, they put Gil on with Richie. And if Gil had a gig, they put Richie on with Gil. So that's how it was working. So we were doing this tour up and down the East Coast of America. And on the tour, I think we were in Virginia. And I was doing what I normally do when I've got Gil to myself kind of thing, which was to just sit down and tell him all my problems, you know.
But that didn't take long.
Well, and Gil wouldn't burden you with his problems. Well, it was therapy for me, Mick. You know what I mean? Gil was like the ultimate therapist.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a polymath. You know, he had an IQ about 160, 170. I mean, he was just off the chain. Mm-hmm. So he could sit there and listen for hours to the most complex issues that you had. And then just within a few sentences, sum it all up, conclude it, and tell you precisely what you needed to do about it. He just had that ability. Wow. Few people have that ability. So I found ways to be able to really like get it all off my chest with Gil. There was no consequences to anything I was going to say. You know, if you sit there and start talking to your family, then they get anxious about it or they get angry about it or whatever. Yeah. I was talking to Gil, like he had no skin in the game. So it wasn't like, you know, I could say anything to him. So I would tell him all the issues, all the problems or whatever. And then one day we were in Virginia and he said to me, you're not the only one who had some problems, you know? He said, I've been writing this. Listen to this. And then he read me a poem. This is in February of 1988, which he never released on the album until the last tour in 2010. And the poem was called On Coming From a Broken Home.
I want to make this a special tribute to a family that contradicts the concepts, heard the rules but wouldn't accept. And women folk raised me and I was full grown before I knew I came from a broken home. Since I lived with my grandma down south, where my uncle was leaving and my grandfather had just left for heaven, they said, And as every ologist would certainly note, I had no strong male figure, right? But Lily Scott was absolutely not your mail order, room service, typecast black grandmother. I was moved in with her, temporarily, just until things were patched. Till this was patched, until that was patched. Until I became at 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, the patch that held Lily Scott, who held me. And like them four, I became one more. And I loved her from the absolute marrow of my bones. And we was holding on. I come from a broken home. She had more than the five senses. She knew more than books could teach. And raised everyone she touched just a little bit higher. And all around her, there was a natural sense. As though she sensed what the stars say, what the birds say, what the wind and the clouds say. A sense of soul and self, that African sense. And she raised me like she raised four of her own. And I was hurt and scared and shocked when Lily Scott left suddenly one night. And they sent a limousine from heaven to take her to God, if there is one. So I knew she had gone. And I came from a broken home.
I'm coming from a broken home, from Gil's last album, was it? I'm New Here?
Yeah, that's from the last album, I'm New Here, which we were touring in 2010 through 2011. So that turned out to be the last tour. And then Gil sadly passed away. So, you know, it was a memorable tour. I actually got to spend a lot of quality time with Gil because Gil didn't like to fly unnecessarily, and the band were flying up and down the UK, so I ended up driving him. So the band flew and me and Gil drove. So we drove from, you know, to the Liverpool gig at the Philharmonic and up to Manchester and then up to Scotland. We were at the Picture House in Edinburgh, and, you know, I remember...
How was his state of mind and health at this point?
Well, I mean, Gil was, you know, he was in a state of clarity. You know, he'd obviously been through some difficulties. He'd been in prison for a while, and he'd come out of that, and he produced this last album. And, you know, he was really having a renaissance. He was having a comeback. You know, even in the album's called I'm New Here, and there's a track on there, the title track, which says, you know, no matter how far wrong you've gone, you can always come around. And it was that whole notion that, like, you know, you might have been down, but you're not out. Like, there's always a way back, and there's always hope. And, you know, the album was sick, and the tour was sold out, and we were doing gigs every single night. We were in Sweden, Norway, Holland, Belgium, France, Germany, Switzerland. I mean, we were everywhere, do you know what I mean? But it was, I think the last night of the last tour was in Rome. And we were doing the Dissonant Dance Festival in Rome on a rooftop built by Mussolini, a white marble rooftop. And they asked us to do this pop-up gig.
He didn't think that a black revolutionary would be playing in his...
You know what I mean?
In the halls of his fascism.
Exactly. It was mad. But, you know, sometimes you just got to take over these spaces and just, you know, and put good vibes in them. Exactly. Yeah. So... we'd been asked to do this this show at the Dissonance Dance Festival, like a pop-up show in this 15th century monastery where no one knew who Gil was. And me, the promoter, and Gil sort of wandering through the streets of Rome, literally, like these ancient streets. Mm. And then just before we got to this monastery, we bump into Jamie Bing, who was Gil's publisher, who from Canongate, who publishes all Gil's work. And he'd actually been on the first night of the tour at the Royal Festival Hall with a whole film crew from Ridley Scott. And he was like filming us all and interviewing Gil. And then he took Gil off to do some footage with him, some, you know, interview footage with Gil doing some performances. And he'd edited the stuff up while we'd been on tour, and he'd brought it to Rome to show Gil on the last night what he'd edited. So it ended up being me, him and Gil back at the hotel in Italy, which turned out to be the last night that I actually saw Gil alive. But while he was showing Gil the footage, there was a caption in the footage where Gil talked about his grandmother, Lily Scott, and how she inculcated values in him when he was a child. And one of those values was, if you could help someone, why wouldn't you? And when I heard that, I just burst into tears, because at this point, my life had come full circle. I'd been with him for 27 years now. I'd gone from being illiterate to having a master's degree. You know, I'd gone from being homeless to owning a house. You know, I'd gone from being on my own to having a family. You know, now I'm doing a PhD at Cambridge with a full scholarship, you know, so this is all under his mentoring. And I just, you know, it all came full circle, if you like, in that moment. And, you know, Gil was comforting me on one side and Jamie was comforting me on the other side, and I'm sitting there in tears. And but beautiful. I didn't know at beautiful. That point that was the last time I was ever going to see him alive, because shortly after that, I came back to the UK, and then a couple of months later, I'd been trying to reach Gil because some dates had been cancelled and I couldn't reach him. And then I got a phone call from Mick, actually, on Sunday morning, saying, I'm really sorry to hear about Gil. And I'm like, what about him? And he was like, haven't you heard? And I was like, heard what, Mick? I mean, literally, he woke me up. It was Sunday morning. Do you remember, Mick?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
And yeah, that's how I actually found out.
I know. I felt terrible afterwards, but it was on all the news and everything. And I thought, because I knew your relationship with him.
And then I came in, and our first interview I did was on Up Front that night on BBC Radio Merseyside with you.
That's right, yeah. Well, look, I think it's fair to say we can't thank you enough for coming in today, because I think it's been a bloody privilege, to be honest.
Yeah. To hear your story firsthand.
It has been. Fantastic. And we must mention that there's a lot more to Malik's story than we've heard today. The book is called Letters to Gil by Malik al-Nazir. It's a memoir. It's been out a couple of months. It's had some amazing reviews. Times Literary Supplement, Guardian, Times, you name it. And that's published by William Collins.
Okay, we got the CD as well, which I'm going to thieve. Rhythms of the Diaspora, Volumes 1 and 2. Yeah, I can't wait to listen to that.
And we're going to end with Black and Blue, and then that's going to segue into Immigrants Free at Last.
Yeah, so they're by Malik and the OGs, which is my band.
Yep.
And Black and Blue, Gil actually recorded that for me before he passed away. And we did a tribute in Liverpool in 2015 at St. George's Hall called The Revolution Will Be Live. So I launched this album, Rhythms of the Diaspora, Volumes 1 and 2, featuring Gil Scott-Heron and the Last Poets, to celebrate his legacy. So, you know, this version of Black and Blue it's my production and it's my song, but it's actually narrated on the verses anyway by Gil himself.
So this has been a definitive Misadventures in Music, I think, isn't it, Ian?
Absolutely. Probably my favourite one so far.
Yeah.
Iconic. About myself,
iconic. So. I'll go down in history.
Well, you know what? The important thing is keeping Gil's legacy alive, because he is alive in his music, you know, which I play all of the time. And you feel as though he's there, don't you? That's the power of music that can transcend death.
It is, and, you know, I'm part of his legacy because he instilled knowledge and information and effort and energy into me, and I'm trying to continue to keep his memory alive, but also to continue the revolution as well, you know, and that's my own work, you know. My body of work is following on from that, just as Gil had continued from the Harlem Renaissance and Langston Hughes and the, you know, the Black Arts Movement of Mary Bracken and the Last Poets. You know, my poetry is also another generation, you know, and I mentor young people as well now to try and keep passing that on. And it's like a each one teach one thing, you know. That's
if you
important.
Can, if you can help someone, why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you? You know.
Life can be so sad when you're black and blue, running round in circles, you don't know what to do, with all the worries in the world beating down on you. It's a little wonder why you cry when you're black and blue. Every day is a bad old day when you're black and blue. The good times only memories or dreams that might come true. Night and day you ponder what the world is coming to, but still you're left to wonder why. Black, you're always blue.
My black blue. Don't give up. You've got to stand strong, cause God has been blue. Don't mean you can't get along. Black is bright. Blue just a feeling. Spread little virtue that defines our
seems to matter what you say or what you do. Close your ears and close your eyes, the truth gets to you. To stand and fight, to run and hide, to turn and face the truth. The sweetness flows from lion's bones, but first came black to blue.
My black blue, don't give up. You've got to stand strong just cause you've been blue. Don't mean you can't get along. Black is bright. Blue's just a feeling. Strength is a virtue. That's the price our people.
No one says you have to cry because you're black and blue. Wipe the tears out from your eye and view the world anew. Turn your worries into rhythm, troubles into song. Cause black and blue are always beautiful as night and day are.
I'm black and blue.
Mandela's rage for the world to see, but the wisdom of a southern sage came so naturally. Western leaders all put to shame for their complicity in the evil that apartheid reigned for a century. So the Englishman in Spain,
yes, he's an immigrant.
The white farmer on American plane,
yes, he's an immigrant.
Marie Le Pen on a foreign train,
yes, she's an immigrant.
EDL at a Euro game,
they're all immigrants.
Europeans to Australia came,
criminal immigrants.
Took the land left Aboriginals lame,
indigenous immigrants.
England took Palestine again,
crusader immigrants.
Zionist Palestinian claims,
Jewish immigrants.
Stay true to you, stay true to me. Don't be afraid.
In the Mediterranean,
full of immigrants,
escaping coups for Mark Thatcher's gain.
Coups for immigrants.
The Tories need someone to blame.
Blame the immigrants
for their bankers' roulette game.
Causing immigrants.
Theresa May wants them all in jail
because they're immigrants.
Express News manufactures fame
for the immigrants.
A Rupert Murdoch's hard to frame,
but he's an immigrant.
They hate themselves, that's why they're all the same.
They're all immigrants.
Stay true to you, stay true to me. Don't be afraid.
Prince Philip was a Greek who came as an immigrant. The Queen's German roots are a shame.
She's an immigrant.
As every Saxon patriot claims,
they're all immigrants.
Checky rooty where the Saxons came,
a bunch of immigrants.
And the Angles were up to the same tricks,
they were immigrants.
Our royals are French since 1066,
royal immigrants.
William the Norman took the crown for his,
he's an immigrant.
French Nobleshire up the biz,
they're all immigrants.
Stay true to you, stay true to me, don't be afraid. Speak peace for the future, died in the past, from the start to the grave.
We should be free at last.
How did you become so cruel? These are people who use the rule. All your riches came at their expense. Now you want to cage them with a wire fence. All they want is just a chance to live. You act like all you do is give. But if the truth be told, all you do is take. You destroyed their countries with all those weapons you make.
Stay true to you, stay true to me, don't be afraid. Speak peace, fall for the future, died in the past, from the start to the grave.
We should be free at last.
Stay true to you, stay true to me, don't be afraid. Speak peace, fall for the future. Died in the past, from the start to the grave.
We should be free at last.
Get your information out instantaneously. Communicate with people simultaneously. Sleight of tongue, press make you up erroneously. Write a new joint, settle the score righteously.